You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 132 for March 14th, 2018. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk to lithics expert, Dr. John Whitaker. I'm sure you've all seen his book. So get out your strip of leather and your gloves because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Stephen in Calgary.
Hello.
Sonia in Utah.
Hello.
Doug in Scotland.
Hey.
And possibly Bill in California, but he had some issues getting into the office today, so we'll see if he just joins us later on. I think that's becoming the theme for Bill. We just need to have a canned recording of him saying hello, and then when he jumps into the podcast, we'll be good to go.
I think I'm starting to refer to it as Bill time. He's Bill on time. Bill time.
Nice. He's spent too much time in St. Croix, I think. Okay. All right. Sounds good. And I think Ruckus is also with us today, and then we might also hear Sonia's new pal. What's his name again, Sonia?
His name's Fisher.
Fisher. Nice. Okay. Just to show you that we're all humans and we all have this personal side going down. Also, I'm in a hotel room. I haven't recorded in a hotel room for a long time, so there might be noises and things like that. My wife's getting ready to go because we're packing up literally right at the end of this recording. Anyway, we have a great show today, and this was born out of a conversation I had with a friend and then talking to the hosts here about this. And we're like, well, let's just bring on somebody who knows something about flint knapping and we'll talk about it. So our guest today, he really does need no introduction. I mean, I don't know a single person that doesn't either know of or have his book that we'll talk about, but we'll do a short introduction anyway. Dr. John Whitaker is an anthropological archaeologist, and I got that off his Grinnell College page that he likes to be called that, and an expert in prehistoric technologies. Like I said, nearly everyone knows about or owns his book, Flint Knapping. It's the one with the orange and black cover. And he also published a more recent book, which we did talk about a little bit on the Archaeology Show episode that he was on, and I'll link to that in the show notes, but it's called American Flintknappers. Again, that was episode 8, and it was on the Atlatl. It was a really great episode, and that will be linked in the show notes. So, Dr. John Whitaker, welcome to the show. How's it going?
I'm in good shape. It's cold here.
Yeah, I bet it is. So is there anything, first off, I mean, you've done quite a few things. You're still, you know, you're a professor, you're doing a bunch of different things. Is there anything you wanted to mention in that introduction that I didn't mention, that I didn't get to?
No, that's fine. Working? I'm still teaching at Grinnell College, still working in the Southwest, still playing with primitive technologies, best toys around.
Nice. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was both you and your wife, Catherine Camp, that contributed a chapter to one of the last Archaeology Show podcasts we did on the Archaeology of the Night. Did you guys contribute a chapter to that book?
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, that was actually a brilliant concept on the part of April and Nan.
Yeah, it really was. Okay, well, let's get into talking about flint knapping and bifaces and flakes and all sorts of things. So I'm just gonna kick right into this and go from there and see how this goes. And we're just gonna sort of let this flow and see what we can do with it. But I want to talk about bifaces first. And you mentioned in an email to me that yesterday you were making bifaces for us, for a project. So, and that's great. And one of the things that we talk about a lot when we're recording stuff, especially out here in the West, I know particularly we find a lot of bifaces of various stages, we call them, in the Great Basin and all over California. And people generally drop these into, I want to say, a five-stage system. That's generally what's accepted out here. But I have a lot of problems with that, and I want to get your take on this. You know, my problem with judging from a five-stage system, what that means is from some sort of unformed sort of thing to a finished product, and that's the and everything in between. But having a stage system implies you know what the thing is going to look like. And you know what it's going to be used for, which I'm not certain that we always know that when we have something that's what we would call, say, a preform or something like that. So let's start talking about that because I don't remember. We used your book for reference, but how do you feel about this staging system for recording bifaces? Because as archaeologists, you know, we have to write something down when we find something. We have to write something down when we're recording it. And they feel like writing down what stage the biface in is incredibly important. So just what are your thoughts on this initially to begin with?
It's a typology with the flaws and uses of a typology. It's a way of categorizing stuff so we can understand what we're talking about. It's interpretive by nature. And the question is not so much is whether this is what was going on in the minds of the prehistoric folk as to whether it's useful to us describing and analyzing material. And in that sense, I think it is. Although, as with every typology, there are some problems in making sure that everyone understands the definitions the same way.
Yeah. Do you address this in your flintknapping book?
I talk about it a little bit. I use a staging concept that's largely borrowed from Callahan, who's one of the people who originated this idea. But I think about it partly from the point of view of the flint napper and trying to instruct someone in flint napping, which is a little bit different from thinking about it from the point of view of an archaeologist trying to categorize artifacts in the field.
I mean, definitely when you're learning to flint nap and when you're trying to make something, knowing the different stages to go to get up to what your final product is, of course, really important. But as I was saying in the beginning here, my biggest problem with it from a recording standpoint, from an after the fact standpoint, is we don't know what the finished product was going to be, especially for some of the early stage stuff. We have no idea. We can guess that the finished product was going to be something that they considered, you know, finished, whoever the creator of the thing was, that was going to be used in one of various ways of finished products we have. But I mean, realistically, how could we possibly know that? And if we can't know that, you know, what other factors would you suggest somebody record on something they can't collect, they can only take pictures of, and they need to describe?
Well, in the first place, we do know what the finished product is going to be in a limited way, and, well, less limited in some context. If you're working in a manufacturing room, for instance, where they're making projectile points, you know what they're trying to make. If you're working in a Clovis site, you know that many of the large bifaces are going to end up as Clovis points. So you have at least some idea of what they should be aiming for. I think it's also why we use the term biface as a general garbage category for things that we don't know what they're going to end up as.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I'm interested to hear from some of the others. Sonia, you work in the West a lot. I mean, you're based out of Utah. What do you use at your company for determining this? What is your preferred method of recording when you're talking about bifaces?
Usually when we go, when we're out in the field, we'll talk about staged bifaces. And that's for bifaces. We're not talking about flakes as yet or anything like that. We're talking about bifaces. And we generally follow Dr. Whitaker's format, stage one, stage two, all the way up to five being a finished product. Now, it gets a little tricky, of course, when you have curation and then reforming of an artifact. And I can't remember if you addressed this, Dr. Whitaker, but I mean, a stage five biface could start as an Elko projectile point and then end up as, I don't know, something as tiny as a cottonwood triangular. Or one of those teeny weeny little bird points, depending on whether or not we have the right platforms to make those artifacts. So, and obviously by the time we get down to the smaller artifact, we don't know what it was beforehand. So we essentially use the stages, and then once we hit the final product, we may or may not give it a name, the typology name. I mean, obviously you can have knives, and that are not formalized. They're simply a bifacial knife. It's not in a specific format or anything like that. It was just used that way, and it may have been used throughout its various stages for something. We just can't know that. But like I said, we basically use the stages. Once we get to a finalized artifact that's identifiable for typology, we'll give it the formal name. And even I have issues with that. I have issues with typology in general. That's kind of just how we go about it.
Now, that's a good point about the reuse of stuff. And no, I don't deal with that. Although I suppose you could, if you think about the possibilities of Clovis and the different the different stages of finishing. You can subdivide staging into a lot more than the basic early, middle, and late, which is really what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could think of a broken Elko point as the, you know, a late stage preform for a
like a DSN, a desert side notch, or a cottonwood triangular. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these are tiny points.
Yes. And we do get that. And sometimes also the culturally appropriate finished product is a sort of a generalized biface, a knife, if you want to call it that.
I guess from a teaching standpoint then, you know, we're always talking about, you know, everybody on this call has had people work for them at some point in time. And, you know, we always have to, you know, train new people in these methods. From a teaching standpoint, what would you teach somebody who's coming right into the field and saying, this is how we record? You know, I'm to reiterate what Sonia said a little bit, I also don't like naming things. I don't like naming things in the field at all, even if I know what we typically would call this thing. I don't feel like that's our job when we're first just like right in the field recording a brand new site that nobody's ever seen before. And I feel like our job is to just be descriptive as possible. So later on, we can go through and start, you know, because when you start naming stuff, you're starting to do analysis. You're starting to apply some sort of cultural significance or some sort of timeline to it, which really in the field, we just need to focus on heavy, heavy description. Make sure we describe this thing because possibly no one will ever see it again because maybe it's going to be an open pit mine in a few months or a highway or something like that. So we just need to get along the job of description. So from that standpoint, what would you advise somebody who has to record these things and see these things all the time? What are the most important attributes to record about stuff like this if you have a short period of time and you can only take photographs and notes and no one's ever going to see it again?
kind of
a tall order.
Well, that's one reason we use some descriptive terms that encapsulate a bunch of information as a shorthand.
Right.
And in some sense, there's a justification for doing a little bit of this kind of interpretive naming in the field, because in the field, you are the closest person to it. You are the one who has the most detail at hand when you're making the decision. So a combination of, you know, using a standard name if we're talking about projectile points, and describing and photographing should do the trick, I think.
Mm-hmm.
As far as teaching a new individual what we want to record about bifaces seen in the field, depends partly on some flint napping experience.
Mm-hmm.
If they have none, we have to rely more on things like overall size and, I don't know, thickness. You ought to be able to explain to them about platforms and edges a little bit. They should know what the typical finished products in that part of the world are going to end up as, whether it's points or knives or what have you. Yeah, the non-diagnostic, Sonia's comment, the projectile point knives. Well, that's why we use these general terms too.
Mm-hmm.
That if you get we have a lot of things that as archaeologists we don't really feel that we can categorize accurately, either for what's going on in prehistory or for explanation to a colleague.
It's interesting when you said, assuming someone doesn't know anything about flint napping or hasn't taken, you know, some sort of informational course in one way or another, man, that is the common thing though. I would say that it's more common for people not to have a flint napping course in, say, college than it is to have one. I mean, I got lucky when I was in my undergrad that they only offered this flint napping course when the professor decided to have it that semester. And in the 2 years that I was really focusing on archaeology, as you know, finishing in my anthropology major, they decided to offer that flint napping course. And I took it, and that was my only experience of flint napping. But then I went to work in the East Coast and in a lot of areas where really, for the next few years, actually, where really what we were more finding was pottery. Found very little lithics, like in the coastal plain of South Carolina and things like that. I mean, we did find some, but pottery was the name of the game down there. And we were just finding tons and tons and tons of that. So my knowledge of flint knapping and, you know, stages and actually do that and working the points was slowly eroding away. And then when I got into the West, hit it hot and heavy again. But still, I think a lot of people come out here to the West where there's just points all over the place and very little pottery or anything else. And they've never had a flint knapping class. They may have heard about it. They may have studied it a little bit in college, but they've never done it. And that's definitely an oversight, but something that we have to deal with all the time.
Well, I don't expect that very many people are going to actually have a flint knapping class. Mm-hmm. They should be exposed a little bit to lithic terminology and analysis in a, you know, a more general sense. Mm-hmm. And that's thinking about my own teaching. That's basically what I do in my archaeological field methods class, is I teach them the sort of standard generalized American terms for different kinds of stone tools, including biface as a sort of a garbage category of the things that we don't know what they're going to become. I don't, now that I think of it, actually try to teach them much about staging, although I talk about and I demonstrate that a biface goes through, it develops. It goes through a use life manufacturing sequence.
Okay. Well, I think Bill joined us, but he's having troubles connecting. So I think rather than get into another discussion, we're just going to end this segment about a minute early and we'll fix that and bring Bill back in. So we're going to take a break real quick. As we do that, listen to this message about our member site. It's pretty great. We've got a growing list of members. And in the next couple of months, we're going to be really stepping up the learning content for professional members. So take a look for that. ArcPodNet.com/members. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high quality downloads of each show and a discount at our online store and access to show hosts on a members only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
All right, we are back for Sierra Mark Podcast episode 132, and we are talking about bifaces and flint knapping with Dr. John Whitaker. And Doug, you've got a question to kick off this segment.
Yeah, so it's been a while since I've had to deal with flint knapping and flakes and debitage and lithics. So I'm a little out of the loop, so this might be a question that maybe everyone knows the answer to. But has there been a proposed way to quantify typologies in a somewhat easy, measurable way? Is there a way to say this is a stage 4 biface or a stage 3 that you could do? So last time I did this was about 10 years ago, and you kind of got a description, and you looked at a bunch of stage 1s and a bunch of stage 2s, and you sort of by eye figured out and put it into those categories. Has anyone come up with a way of doing that with some sort of measurements or any sort of tools?
Well, there are defined parameters for each one of the stages, you know, what they're supposed to be. The problem is not everybody knows those parameters exactly. And also they don't really apply them correctly, I think. So John, what do you have to say about the parameters regarding the 5-stage system, or at least several stages?
Well, yeah, but the problem there are, you can use a length width ratios and things like that, but of course the problem remains that it is a continuum, and sometimes a biface that falls by its length and width into one category is still being worked on in other parts of the same biface at what you would probably call a different stage. Because these things are they're really just strategies as you're knapping. And I find that I have a fairly consistent sort of rubric for how I want to knap, but that individual bifaces require individual adjustment as you go along. So they're never going to fit perfectly into any category, which is why a pretty generalized kind of early, middle, late sort of sequences is about all you can do.
Yeah, the early, middle, late thing, I use that a lot because I don't feel like it's even necessary to really nail it down closer than that, because it really comes down to the question we're trying to answer here. You know, what is it? We're not just doing description with this, but we're also answering some sort of question, like saying, okay, is there, you know, a ton of early stage bifaces on the site? Are there a ton of late stage bifaces on the site? I mean, that says something about the use of that exactly. site as well. You know, yeah, what's on there. So that's that exactly. That's definitely what I do. Doug, you've got a follow up to this.
Yeah. Well, similar along a bit what you guys are talking about, you know, it tells you a bit of what's going on there. But how useful is this? So I've done lots of recording where I've definitely, you know, okay, we've got flakes, we've got, you know, so many number of easily identifiable projectile points and bifaces and things like this, and you put them all in there, and it goes into the report. But how helpful do you guys find this? And I'm thinking also not just on individual sites, but in a sense of trying to do, say, a regional analysis of sites that have been surveyed or recorded and stuff like that. Does this typology actually help? Or is it just one of those things where people disagree so much and someone's two is someone's three or is someone's four that it's really hard to do sort of wide-scale analysis? Again, asking from someone who doesn't do wide-scale lithic analysis, how difficult is it to use these sort of typologies?
Well, I think the generalized ones are fairly consistent because they are pretty generalized. Most people are going to understand similar things when you say it's an early stage biface, and I think it does characterize what's going on at a site reasonably well. If I say that there are lots of early stage bifaces at this site, as opposed to one where there are lots of almost finished ones, late stage ones, I think those are likely to be used fairly consistently because they are generalized. It's when you try to start mm-hmm. categorizing things in any typology in a splitter form with lots of detail that you get lots of disagreement among typologists.
Mm-hmm.
We saw this yeah. with ceramic stuff. We did a test with the ceramic typologies used in the Flagstaff area, and had a bunch of different people try to type the same sherds, and found high mm-hmm. degree of agreement among the general categories and a very low degree of agreement among the specific splitting up categories.
Right. That makes sense.
And does that affect when people are doing sort of, multi-site analysis, maybe using different reports across different projects, maybe different companies, so data census, as it were. Is it not, again, a bit not knowing anything here, if you're a lithic expert, is it okay just to have those general categories because people differ so much on the specific? Is it okay when you're doing your larger analysis?
Well, I would say that mostly it's going to be, and I have a lot more faith in a 3 or a 5 point system than I do in a 12 or 20. But in terms of mm-hmm. if I were doing a regional study, I would want not just to read the report and hear that they had 5 early stage bifaces. I would like to see illustrations of them.
That brings up another question that I think we'll save for the last segment. But Stephen, you had a question on strategy and recording.
Yeah. And this is getting maybe this question is getting a little bit stale because I thought of it before Doug started talking. and so some of it's been covered. But, in the case of like Chris, he's, you know, doing a lot of field recording and recording attributes and stuff like that. Is it better to, you know, focus on recording attributes rather than the stages and like Chris was talking about assigning, you know, that level of interpretation later? Mm-hmm. And if so, or even if it isn't, you know, what are those attributes that are the more critical aspect? You know, really, is there a better way of recording this stuff than, going straight to either stages or, you know, whether it's early, middle, late or whatever.
One of the problems with attributes is that they take longer. A typology is intended to summarize a series of attributes so that when you say an early stage biface, you expect other people to understand that it's relatively thick, that it's still got lots of platforms on it, that it may have cortical remnants, you know, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
All of which are attributes that you can record individually and for detailed analysis probably should.
All right. You mentioned, I want to, while we're sticking with this recording theme here, I actually put this down in my third segment notes, but I want to ask it now because it seems appropriate. You mentioned illustration. You know, you see in a report, you know, we've got 10 early stage biphases or middle stage, but you want to see illustrations, right? Well, the fact of the matter is, just like lithic experts that we take with us, which are usually zero on a recording crew, the people asked to do illustrations have almost universally no illustrating credentials whatsoever. Like they've never illustrated anything in their lives. And we're like, hey, go record those points and draw them while you're at it. And like, shoot, okay, I guess I'll figure that out. For somebody, now taking aside that somebody should really have some illustration training and figure out what to do, what to actually focus on and things like that. If you were to tell somebody that had never illustrated a point before, what some of the things they should focus on are, because I think as ad hoc artists go, we tend to focus on, say, you know, the boundary of the point and then covering some of the big lithic scars and things like that, some of the big flake scars, sorry, and things like that. But what would you say are some of the most important things to illustrate as far as detail goes and some things to focus on if you're telling somebody who's new at this to go illustrate a point?
Well, first of all, I would say take a photograph.
Right.
and then as far as finished points, the outline is what we mostly use for typologizing them, for categorizing. And I realize that going further on, you can't possibly illustrate everything in a short CRM report. And someone who's going to do a serious regional study for a dissertation or whatever is going to have to ultimately go look at either the specimens if they were collected, or preferably photo logs that go with the field recording.
Yeah, photographs. Great photographs are the name of any recording game, I would say.
Yeah, they're so easy with all this digital stuff now.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, I've got an app that I use on the iPad that I'll take a photograph of a point and then illustrate it actually on that app with the point in the background. So much easier these days to basically just trace it for all intents and purposes, but to get down the right things. Then you have the illustration, but you also have the high quality photograph. So somebody could actually come and re-illustrate that later or, you know, something. As long as you have decent photographs, I mean, taking photographs of points while they're sitting on the dirt and not on some sort of photo board, probably not the best thing for future scientists to look at.
In terms of field analysis, so when we're out documenting an archaeological site, what would you consider the most critical characteristics of to document for flakes and then separately for bifaces or tools?
You asking me?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we've got length, width, thickness for tools, maybe shoulder and base and that sort of thing, assuming we're dealing with a biface. But like in terms of flakes, like there are a lot of archaeologists who go out and do a cursory analysis of flaked stone in the field. And some of our clients want more, some less. So what would you say are the most critical or most important aspects of those, let's just say flakes to start off with?
Well, again, there's a time issue involved in, and also
exactly
depends on whether you're going to be allowed to collect or not. So if you just have to describe it in the field and leave it there, which is all too common, I don't know. There are a number of typological systems going around. There's the, you know, the old primary, secondary, tertiary, which is largely based on presence of cortex and is unreliably applied. There's the Sullivan and Rosen one, which I detest. It's lithics for idiots,
because it's not based on any interpretive stuff at all, and it doesn't translate well into any interpretation. There's I use a simple distinction between things that are probably biface thinning flakes and things that are probably not. And then you can use some basic size categories. In the field, you can't get too elaborate. In the lab, I have they break down into quite a number of different categories. But you really have to go with something simple if you're just recording in the field, if that's all you're limited to. And raw right. material then is the other variable that is of particular interest.
Recently, we've been doing some in-field analysis, primarily on data recovery projects that don't that we've done excavations in one area, but the client or the agencies involved requested we do a surface analysis mm-hmm. of the rest of the site. Sure. And we had used and I can't remember who developed the protocol. They used a more local, I think, practice where we also discuss platform and then completeness of the uh-huh. of the flake.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with that? What would you consider that valuable?
Yes, I think those are both of interest.
Okay.
And you can do rough size sorting. What I do in the lab, I don't measure every flake when I'm analyzing stuff. I use a size category system with little squares that you can, you know, fit a flake on and decide whether it's a 0 to 2 centimeters or 2 to 4 or above 4. You can categorize it any way you want. But that's mm-hmm. a fairly quick way to measure without measuring.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and I think, John, what you're finding out here and the thing that we deal with, you know, one thing is all of us here on this call are in different locations in the United right. States. We all work in different areas, you know, we're all in different spaces. But one just common problem with cultural resource management and the archaeology side of that in particular is that we all have a generalized knowledge of a lot of things
yes.
And very few of us have specific knowledge about specific things. And the things we usually have specific knowledge about, maybe something we studied in college, undergrad or graduate degree, only comes up, you know, once every 100 projects in our actual field work. So because of CRM archaeology, you don't typically get to choose where you go. You go where the work is and you go where the job is. And so you end up just doing that job because you need to pay the bills and you're doing these things. And so we end up with people who are, I don't want to say unqualified, but definitely underqualified to actually do, you know, really great work on something and do things in a way that we would probably all want that to happen. I'm not really stating this properly, but it's just a problem of education, and it's, you know, it's a difficult problem to solve because, like I said, people are all over the place. They're from different areas. They may come to the Great Basin and have never seen a projectile point before, honestly, except for in books. Maybe they've never seen one. And now they're being asked to not only record one, but illustrate it and say, here's this sheet with 5 stages on it. Pick one of those based on what you see and your lack of experience. And you're the last word on this ever, because we're not collecting it. No one will ever see it. Hopefully you take a good photograph.
Well, here's a hypothetical question. Will it matter yeah. that much in the future? So right now, photogrammetry right now, so-so, and you'd have to process it in the field to make sure you got all the right photos and stuff, but you can get handheld laser scanners relatively mm-hmm. cheap. Are we heading towards a way that basically when you're going out and recording, we're now just going to take the raw data, so better than a photo, you do a laser scan, and you'll have, you know, all the dimensions and the surface down to whatever millimeter level accuracy. Is it something where in the future when we record stuff, we're just simply going to do a scan, put a barcode or some sort of identification number on it, and then when it gets back to someone in the lab or you just email it to them, they then look at it and make all the sort of interpretation? Are we heading that way?
Hmm.
Open question to anyone.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I'll just be honest with myself. I have definitely thought about that as the way to go. Photogrammetry obviously is easier than laser scanning because you can do photogrammetry with just the right amount of light and background and an iPhone, quite frankly. I've done it before. So as long as you have the right photographs and the right amount of photographs, you can do photogrammetry. The problem with photogrammetry is that it takes a lot of data, it takes a lot of processing, and it takes a lot of time. You know, even a small projectile point with 30 photos is going to take hours on a computer to really go from beginning to end. And I don't mean just the processing time, but also the photo management and organizing and making sure everything is colored correctly and all this other stuff. There's a lot of work involved to photogrammetry. Some of that process has been automated by awesome programs like Photoscan. But again, there's a lot of prep work to do ahead of time. And then you got to ask yourself, well, who's going to pay for this? It's not the standard method of recording that we use. It's going to take extra time. And my thing is, though, with photogrammetry, the other reason why I love it is you can just take all the photos. And in the, from a field standpoint, just simply taking the photos, especially if you're using a photo management application where you don't have to write all this down, that's the easy part. We can let somebody else worry about processing and doing all those other things if they get a grant to go analyze the, you know, the points on a project or something like that. If maybe the client's not asking for that level of analysis, so nobody's paying for it, somebody may pay for it later on, and at least we'll have the data to start with. That's how I see photogrammetry. Laser scanning is a whole other problem because laser scanners are not light, not cheap, and probably don't have batteries that will last all day. And it's not something you probably want to throw in your backpack either, those handheld laser scanners. So I don't know. Let's go to break real quick, though, and we'll wrap up this discussion on the other side because I know some of you guys have some other questions that you want to ask. So we'll be back in 30 seconds to wrap up episode 132, and stick with us. The Archaeology Podcast Network has partnered with TeePublic to bring you some awesome gear that looks good, promotes archaeology, and puts a few pennies in our pockets so you can get free podcasts. Check out our designs at arcpodnet.com/shop. That's arcpodnet.com/shop. Okay, we're back for Sierra Mark episode 132 with Dr. John Whitaker. We're talking all about flintknapping and bifaces and things like that. Bill, you wanted to start this segment off with a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I definitely... Well, I have a statement mainly about recording points and other lithic materials in the field. As someone who spent a lot of time learning historical archaeology as a way to survive in the West, where everybody else knew lithics or ceramics or something, a lot of times I found myself on mixed teams where people had different expertise and different experiences. For example, in Arizona specifically, you're going to come across ceramics, and that, you know, was divided down to, you know, the section of the county in a lot of ways. Some people were really excellent with certain polychromes or certain kind of things coming out of New Mexico. And then other people knew the Hohokam stuff really well. So you'd be on these crews where there were some people who had spent, you know, hundreds of hours working on thousands of sherds, right? And it was the same thing with lithics. There were some people who had spent thousands of hours working on lithics. And then I'm not going to tell you how many hours I spent looking at bottle glass and metal and other stuff. It's probably pretty depressing. But at any rate, do you think that this is something where someone who's interested in lithics should really focus on learning that? And maybe we all just kind of stick with the basics, just the minimal understandings, and then do our best to record it so that we can pass it off to the expert. Basically what I'm saying is, should we really be worrying about every single person knowing everything about lithics?
Oh, we can't possibly. Archaeology is always multidisciplinary, and nobody is trained in everything. I do lithics well, but some kinds of ceramics, I find myself way out of my depth. If I were in a contract situation, or for that matter, even a research situation, you just run into things you don't know. And yes, then you do the best you can to record them. I think it was also interesting that what Doug had a comment about does it matter in some ways. One of the issues in archaeology that students find hard to get is that there's always an economic component in terms of how much is it worth investing in effort to record a certain amount of data, because you can record infinitely down to the most minute detail, but does it tell you anything? So the issue is, are we getting the information that we need to understand what's going on in the past and to understand from a contract point of view whether a site is important enough to avoid or mitigate or whatever, right?
Yeah, that's an incredibly good point there. You know, doesn't make any sense. Bill, keep going.
Yeah, then following up on that, do you think we should just focus on photoing it and doing the measurements and then just leaving it at that with the understanding that, you know, that information, especially if you're using a tablet-based system, is going to be updated and someone back at the home base or working on another project, someone else in the company can look at those photos and say, oh yeah, that's a desert sign. Oh, I don't know. That looks kind of like a Chiricahua. So do you think that we should just focus on measurements and stuff and, you know, move real quick and take a lot of photos with a good photo board and then just pass that on to someone else? Basically, should we really be spending a whole bunch of time categorizing points and flakes in the field?
I don't know. There's some argument to be made for not handling things twice. The field operative is the person who sees it most quickly, and if it's within their area of expertise, they should make an interpretation. There's always going to be some second guessing and some reanalysis back in the lab, and there should be, but you don't want to keep going over and over this, and you don't want to just keep passing the buck by taking data that you don't understand and hoping that someone will be able to do something with it later.
Right. Well, I think based on, you know, what John, both you and Bill were saying, sometimes we have to think about the actual reasons why we're doing something at the time, though. And one of those things is, you know, we're out on a project and we're being asked by the client to basically figure out, is there anything here that's going to cost them more money and make them stop working? I mean, that's really what the question we're trying to answer is for the client. Obviously, from an ethical and an archaeological standpoint, we're answering other questions, but those are secondary to who's paying for the project and what they want. And so, looking at it, like I think what Bill was saying is, I kind of agree with that. First off, I always try to find out the people on my crew, you know, what is your expertise? What do you think you're best at? And try to put them in that category so we can have the best people in the best positions. But I may have a crew of four people and none of them are really great at lithics. I mean, that just might be it. So we'll go over what we want to record. We'll go over what we want to do and say, listen, I want to, you know, record these attributes of these things. Don't bog yourself down in an interpretation. We're just going to figure out what's going on here and then move on, because that amount of data we'll be able to tell our client, yes, this is a significant site. Because I mean, we don't generally determine significance based on, I guess, the type of point that is found necessarily. I mean, something might be more significant to say, like, you know, an older site or something like that. But generally, it's what is found. And what does that mean about the site function and what was going on there? And that will help us determine significance, but not necessarily the type of point. So if that's not really important right then and there for that report, then write down as much information as we can and move on, you know?
Yes. And also sometimes from the archaeological point of view, the object is to record as much of that site as you think is informative and you're never going to come back to it.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm a quibble a little bit here. And
say, of course you are.
I would say, while the client is important, the client is hiring usually the client would be, say, a mining company or the, you know, whoever's paying for the money for the construction. Sometimes that's the government, sometimes it's private sector, whatever. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, the requirements are being set by your SHPO or by the BLM or by whoever the managing overarching organization is. So most clients would say, actually, we don't need archaeology. Please don't do it. And then when you ask them, you tell them you have to do it, they say, okay, well, our requirement is do it the cheapest way possible. but in a sense, what you really, if the SHPOs decided that actually we want, you know, photogrammetry or 3D scans of all diagnostic or possibly diagnostic lithics, you know, then you would do it. I think it was just going back to the whole, you know, what the client wants and stuff. It could be a shift if, you know, your local SHPO suddenly decides, actually, hey, we want this to be recorded in this way. You know, unless someone, I know it will vary from state to state and organization to organization, right, but they do tend to set some basic standards.
Yeah, but standards are usually set up in advance. If it's coming from the SHPO, it wouldn't be something as expensive or novel as scanning. Like that would have to become more of an industry standard before a SHPO would start requiring it. It could be that the agency who's you know, if it's direct agency involvement, like you're actually contracted to work for the BLM or, you know, some federal agency, if you're working specifically on federal land for a federal agency, they might be like, hey, here's an idea. Let's try this as a, you know, we want to see how well this works. But for a SHPO to require it, especially that, you know, as much of out of the blue as Doug is kind of suggesting, it seems highly unlikely.
Yes, that's very true. I would say in an ideal world they would, but, you know, it could be just something that happens organically. And, you know, it would take like 30 or 40 years and it would start in one state and slowly move across to different people as most of our standards and ways of doing things have gone.
Yeah. Well, I'll refine my statement and say that, you know, we do what we do in service to the client, obviously, because they're the ones that initiated this whole action. It's their land or their leased land or whatever the case may be. But you do that within the confines of the ethical and regulatory standards that have been set up in the framework for what you've been set up to work in. So if the framework says you'll do photogrammetry on every single point that you find, then great. I mean, right now it says in Nevada that we will take at least two photographs of every tool and we will record the GPS points and we'll do all that stuff. And that is the minimum standard of recording. Nowhere does it say we'll determine a typology in the field. Nowhere does it say that. But we do what it says and we do what more we can within the confines of our contract, honestly. And that's why I think developing these more robust recording standards that don't actually cost more time or money, like photogrammetry, it doesn't take that much to just take a bunch of extra photos, especially if you've got a really good photo board to do that on. If you take a bunch of extra photos, the time investment and the actual data investment in that is not that high if you're using the right systems. And it adds a lot more to the scientific record, though. So anyway, we could probably talk about this for a long time. In the last like 7 or 8 minutes here, though, John, I want to ask you something that's really along the lines of bifaces, how we started this conversation. And you kind of alluded to this a little bit. But the other really big point of contention with archaeologists is flakes. Flakes and the nuts that love them. No, flakes and how to record them. And what's actually important. You see different things, you know, tertiary, secondary, primary flakes. You see all these different things. What would you say in your estimate is, I guess, some of the things we should focus on when we're recording flakes? Yeah, what kind of attributes, what kind of things to measure them by? What makes a primary, secondary, and tertiary, really, in your estimate? Things like that.
Right. I guess putting myself in the position of having to do a quick field recording of lithics without the opportunity to take them home to the lab, I would do a very simple categorization based on raw material type, some sort of general quick size grade, and I use a somewhat interpretive typology because it ought to be possible to teach people to understand the difference between an ordinary hard hammer core flake and a biface thinning flake, and those are of considerable interpretive importance that can't really be conveyed by attribute unless you collect a lot of attributes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I would do it. I'd do fairly simple typological size and material categorization.
Okay. Yeah, we see a lot in the West here. I want to get your thoughts on the validity of this, or if it's just another way to really sort them. But we see a lot of things that are based on cortex and percentage of cortex.
That's the primary, secondary, tertiary.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, do you think that's just a handy way for us to mark down the different types of flakes we've got really quickly? Or is there any real scientific value to that other than saying we have quantities here, here, and here? But is that really telling us anything in general about the site?
Well, cortex as an attribute does. That is a useful mm-hmm. attribute because it reflects things like size of the raw material and distance from the source and how much work has been done on a biface. The three simple categories. Again, if you're in the field, you have to use some simplifying, generalizing categories like that. Otherwise, you've got, I don't know, you could lay a little grid over it and you know, quantify the percent of cortex. But some sort of rough visual standard is going to recover as much data as that is, I think, as much useful interpretable data as that would. I mean, you can to give another example, you can measure the orientation of flakes in the dirt. The issue is, will that tell you anything about the formation of the site, or are you wasting your time if it's in fill or on the surface of the site?
Just to jump in, the nice thing about the PST method, primary, secondary, tertiary, is that it is, as long as you define your categories well, like, you know, how much cortex do you have to have for a secondary? Like, is it all, like half cortex, or, you know, there's varying degrees of how people define the secondary. But the really nice thing about it is with a small sample of example flakes, if I get a new hire, it doesn't really matter how much experience they have. I can bring them up to speed on what our definitions are, so that they can use that in a field recording in a pretty efficient fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's critical. Any typology has to be consistent, and it has to be readily learnable to be used.
Yeah, it has to be defined as well on the place where you're recording it. I don't know how many times I've seen a site record, but people say their excuse is, well, we explain the typology that we use in the report. Well, a lot of times the report is completely divorced from the site record. Like you have to go through a lot of extra work to find that report, and you may not have it. But if you have the site record, you know, just putting in there real quick, hey, this is what our primary, secondary, and tertiary determinations are based on. I mean, one of the most common ones that I've seen is, tertiary is zero cortex, secondary is any amount of cortex, and primary is 100% cortex. I've seen that before. But then I've also seen zero to 50% and 50% to 100% defining those three categories. But whatever you use, like you said, make sure people know about it when they look at your form. If I'm looking at a table that has lithics tallied on it, I better see it somewhere in that table. I better see it somewhere really close to that table. Okay, so we're wrapping up this discussion. We've just got a few minutes left. Does any of my panelists have any real final questions for John?
Oh, good. I'm off the hook.
Well, I could toss something out there. Are you still, you know, this is completely unrelated. Do you guys still do the atlatl competitions?
Yes.
Well, because Luther was involved with that. Luther College.
Yes, that's right. Betts. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm a Luther alum, so you know, I got to root for the home team.
I haven't heard from Colin for a while. I think the team lapsed up there.
Okay.
Up and down too. Mm-hmm. But yes, I'm hosting an event at the end of April, and I still take students to things. And I've got a field methods class and a class that's talking about warfare and violence. So they're all going to go out and try atlatls and bows and arrows and talk about it a bit.
Nice.
But atlatls are just such a good way to teach people.
Well, aside from the upcoming atlatl competitions, John, do you got anything else coming down the line that you wanted to mention on the podcast? Any publications come out? We mentioned the great article that you and your wife had in the recent volume Archaeology of the Night. Do you have anything else coming up that you want to mention?
No, we're working on issues of, you know, Kathy works with children a lot, and I'm interested in issues of learning and how well do or how rapidly can people learn different kinds of technologies, specifically projectile technologies in this case.
Okay.
So that's a project that I'm thinking about right now.
Nice. All right. Well, I think that will do it then. Hopefully this cleared up some things for some people, or maybe it just made things more unclear because that's how archaeology works. Yeah. But anyway, thanks a lot, John, for coming on. And again, if you don't have his book, then you're probably either not an archaeologist or just not that interested in lithics. I don't know what to tell you, but you should probably pick it up just so you can have it and you can refer back to it, because it's a really fantastic resource for all of us to have used. So thanks again, John, for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for including me. This was fun.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question in a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Adios.
Bye. Bye. See ya.
Every time.
Bye.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.